This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
I'm sorry about your daughter, Joel.
I'm sorry about your daughter, Joel. But I have lost people, too.
You have no idea what loss is.
Everyone I have cared for has either died or left me.
Everybody, fucking except for you. Don't tell me that I would be safer with someone else, because the truth is, I would just be more scared.
Beware, spoiler-phobes! You have stumbled into a storm of spoilers, a podcast currently covering The Last of Us Season 2 and split into two sections. The first section of the podcast we call The Calm, where we can only talk about things that happened on the series up to Season 2, Episode 7, Convergence, so all of Season 2. The second section of the podcast we call The Storm, as in a storm of spoilers, where we talk about unseen adaptation changes from The Last of Us Part 2 of the game and speculate on what we might see in the next season and beyond. We're not ruining, we're enriching, and we're not infected yet. Hello, I'm Dave Gonzalez.
And I'm Neil Miller. Welcome back once again to A Storm of Spoilers. Before we get started, I've got some housekeeping for us. Our upcoming schedule, some important things in here. We're, of course, have this finale to discuss for The Last of Us. And then next week, we're going to be doing a season recap. We're going to give away some end of season awards. We're also going to answer any lingering questions that you may have, calm and storm alike, and make some predictions about what we may see in season 3 or season 4, in whatever decade those come to us. In the future. So we'll be continuing to break those down. And then following that, we're going to get into Star Wars mode. We're going to have a kind of a special treat for you the week after we do our season recap. And then we're going to get into some Andor season 2 deep dives. That is, of course, all available currently on the Disney Plus application. And we're going to break those down just as they were released. So four blocks of three mini series movie version chunks. And we'll discuss as we go.
Made as much sense while they were doing it as it does now. Yep. We're going to have to definitely talk about what happened there. I mean, probably a run for Emmys. It was a run for Emmy nominations.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, whatever. I mean, we trust in Tony Gilroy, and looking forward, we got some very fun stuff planned for the Andor season 2 deep dives. So we hope you'll stick with us there. If you are interested in The Last of Us and would like to know how the story concludes, I have some good news for you. I've been streaming, as you know, on my Twitch channel, twitch.tv/Neilstradamus, every Monday evening. And this past Monday was supposed to be the end, the finale of the entire game. I was going to finish Last of Us Part 2, but a Seattle-like storm rolled through Austin, Texas about an hour into my stream, just as things were getting very dramatic, and knocked out my power, and it was out for like several hours. So, but the stream did not make it all the way through. So if you're listening to this on Wednesday, when this episode drops, I will be back on tonight, 8 o'clock Central on Wednesday evening, to conclude my Last of Us Part 2 journey. You know, we'll see how this whole thing ends. If you really want to know where the Abby and Ellie, convergence goes from here. I personally cannot wait to finish it, and hope that the power grid of Texas holds for this just one more night. So that's the schedule for Storm of Spoilers. If you'd like more from Dave and I, you can, of course, join us at patreon.com/DaveandNeil, DaveandNeil, for more content, tons more content. We have on the Patreon our Twin Peaks rewatch project that we concluded earlier this year. You can get access to our Slack, which has a bunch of wonderful humans in it. You can get access to bonus content from our previous projects here on Storm of Spoilers, the Lost rewatch, the Game of Thrones years. And you can also get access for members of the $10 level or above, the Leftovers project, which is also concluding this week. We're on the season, the series finale of The Leftovers. Very excited. We're going to be doing that and then a series recap. And then we're going to be moving into covering episode by episode through Hannibal, a show that I have never actually seen all the way through. But Dave has. So I'm excited to continue being a call me, even though Dave is going to be able to go back to being a stormy.
I get to read more books. I'm very excited.
Yeah. So join us for Hannibal as we eat the rich. And that'll be fun. And you can also get access at any level of our Patreon to the weekly pop culture adventure episodes, which we just concluded May of the Dead. Next month, we're doing something fun with movies that about cars that go vroom, vroom, vroom. That's a little bit of a spoiler. We haven't even announced that on the pop culture adventure yet. But you're hearing it first because you are amazing subscribers to this feed. So join us on the Patreon. It's going to be fun times all summer long with Mads Mikkelsen and Fast Cars. All right. On to how you can get in touch with this show. Something you should definitely do in between now and next week, especially if you have questions about season two of The Last of Us or beyond. Questions, theories about what's going to happen in season three or four. And questions about the adaptation, venting that you would like to get off your chest about how you feel about what has happened on this show in its second season. You can always send a raven to stormofspoilers@gmail.com. We have some great ones that we're going to read. You can also review us on iTunes or leave us a comment and a rating on Spotify. The rule, of course, is you leave us a 5-star rating. You can say anything you want. I did bring one this week, Dave, from someone who did not follow the rules. But I found it kind of funny because someone with the handle HGJFD very simply gave us 3 stars and said, "Pretty good!" exclamation mark, which I mean, found confusing.
I get it. I also have some problems with the star system. And if you're being honest about the star system, 3 stars is pretty good, right? Sure. Down the middle. Yeah. But yeah, if you go to my Letterboxd, I have like 0 5-star movies because I keep getting nervous of being like, if I do that, then do I have to change my rating for Godzilla X Kong, you know, New Empire? Because like that, I like that movie, but that's a 2-star movie. So now I need to just decide, sure, anything better than Godzilla and Kong and Shimu fighting.
Yeah. And listen, on a site like Letterboxd, when you're talking about a movie, I completely understand. The star rating is very important, and a great debate could be had on what a 3-star movie versus 5-star movie. We are not a movie, though. Give us 5 stars.
That's true.
Say whatever you want.
It's more about advertising. Yes. We would love to hear your real opinion under the 5 stars.
Yeah, it helps us reach more people, which is ultimately the goal here. On to some ravens, some calm, friendly ravens that we have as we jump into the calm and talk about the season 2 finale of The Last of Us. The first one, Raven from Levon in West Australia, who asks, do we think the Van Morrison poster in this episode was included because he lost his mind during COVID? Which is something I had to remind myself of, Dave, that I did not remember that Van Morrison lost his mind and became sort of a anti-lockdown person during COVID. This is so many people did. So many celebrities had moments of extreme.
Evangeline Lilly, what are
Evangeline
you doing?
Evangeline Lilly comes to mind. Yeah. And I wanted to answer this with a kind of a fun fact, which is that we see the Van Morrison poster in the dressing room in the scene with Dina and Ellie. And it's a poster from the tour stop that Van Morrison made at the Seattle Opera House in 1971, a very real tour stop. And what's also true is that in that same year, 71, Van Morrison played a show at the Seattle Paramount Theater, which is the theater upon which this, the theater in The Last of Us, is based. So like the Seattle Paramount, and I think in the game it actually is called the Paramount Theater. Like it's very much rendered as the Seattle Paramount Theater, like the real one. It's not called that here in the show, probably for licensing reasons. Multiple things in this episode are called something different for what I assume are licensing reasons, which we'll get to. But I found that interesting. It, you know, Van Morrison's there. I don't think it has anything to do with him losing his mind during COVID, but yeah, you never know.
No, but I, with a cursory like look, it looks like there was a Moondance cover in the video game, a Van Morrison Moondance cover.
Sure. There's a lot of great music in the game too.
So yeah, being able to sort of adapt that still within being in the game. It sounds like to me that it's not so much he lost his mind during COVID as in there's a Van Morrison fan somewhere in the production of The Last of Us.
Sure.
Be it like as high up as, you know, Druckmann or part of like the assets crew.
Yeah.
But I'm down for it.
Yeah. And I honestly, I do now, having spent a lot of time hearing them converse and interact with each other. I think Neil Druckmann and Craig Mazin are kindred spirits in their love of like rock and especially like Seattle rock and grunge bands and things like that. So that one of the things that maybe connected with Craig Mazin in his journey toward producing the show, I think, was connecting with Neil Druckmann's love of rock music. And that is something that bleeds into the game. So no surprise the Van Morrison is here. All right. Our second Raven, which I found interesting and wanted to bring this one to you, Dave, is from Maddie, who says, seeing that glimpse of Scar Island and the one boy marking Ellie's fate, I feel like an interesting concept would be a miniseries spinoff around the origin of the Seraphites. Coincidentally, though, enough, I recently finished the first season of The Leftovers, so it had me thinking it would be something akin to The Guilty Remnant, but in The Last of Us universe under a fascist-like state with Fedra. For those who have not seen The Leftovers, The Guilty Remnant is pseudo-religious. I guess in the book, The Leftovers, they're a little bit more religious than they are in the show. Pseudo-religious group that gets into extreme nihilism after mm-hmm. the departure of 2% of the population in an event called The Great Departure. So I thought this was kind of interesting because it's, you know, it's about extremists, right? It's about the sort of outlier groups that form, especially under in situations where governmental bodies become a little bit more fascistic, right? After extreme world events like the departure right. or a zombie apocalypse. And this is a parallel that I think The Leftovers and The Last of Us share, other than being HBO shows that start with the and the letter L. But I wanted to get your take there, Dave.
Yeah, no, I think this could be interesting. And I do think it would be a little bit more fun to go down some more of these narrative detours in a third season, if not a miniseries. But I am very curious about the Seraphites. I am very not only curious about the island, but by apparently the, you know, there are two hers, as we see in this episode. There, whoever I thought was a single deity is apparently not. So I have a bunch of questions, some of which I think they're going to answer. I definitely want to talk to you about in the storm of this week, where we think we're going to see things that we see on screen this week pop up later on in the narrative. And the Seraphites and the Seraphite Island are definitely part of that. I'm very curious. I am interested, though, if they do start doing like spinoffs. I think the benefit of a spinoff and to like comp the beginning of the Seraphites to something like The Leftovers would be being able to tell a story in this world outside of, I think, the very focused moral thematics of The Last of Us being an Ellie, Joel, Abby story. So here it's very much about tribalism. It's about like cycles of revenge. And I assume, because I haven't played the video game, that we're going to eventually stick the landing in the Last of Us HBO series with all of these themes sort of coming to a head, you know, motherhood and cycles of revenge and all these things are going to all, you know, clash together. Well, it'd be interesting to, if you break off something like the Seraphites into a mini series, like if you broke off, I don't know, the David and the Cannibals into their own mini series from season one, would be, they could be about something else, which I think is always interesting. And hopefully, you know, something that I think was able to benefit The Walking Dead eventually. So like, we know you are very sad about what's happening to Rick. Let's look at another side of the universe. And I think that's a beneficial way to expand.
Yeah.
So if the Seraphites have something cool about them that can't really thrive inside of the revenge, cycle of revenge, tribalism narrative, then that would be interesting. But I'm also, I don't know, sort of paranoid at that this point, because they've been so built and used so specifically, especially in this episode, to be like, you think you know what's going on, but you have no idea what happens when you complicate that.
Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, that was one of my first thoughts. Maddie doesn't mention this in her email, but my first thought was like, this is an impulse that I feel like comes from what The Walking Dead was able to do, the like IP expansionism that they were able to do once the sort of popularity reached a certain saturation point where it was like, all right, now we can tell stories in this world from different angles. And I think that's possible for The Last of Us. In fact, we got another email that I'm going to read portions of in the storm that discussed that at one point they planned like a multiplayer game that has since been shelved. Where you were going to be able to play like different perspectives in different parts of the world of The Last of Us, which I thought, I always thought was pretty interesting and would love to see them revisit. The other thing that this made me connect this week was some things that Craig Mazin talked about on the official podcast, which is that he was very confidently asserting that we were going to learn not only a lot more about the Seraphites, but sort of what their deal is in season three. And we've been talking in the storm over the last couple of weeks about this idea that he has put out there that it may not just be a season three, but also a season four, which is, you know, a fun way for a showrunner to call their shot and sort of try to tie up more of HBO's money in the future, even though they won't have greenlit for a season three, which I respect, right? Fully respect taking HBO's money and stretching it as far as you can go. But you know, one of the questions is like, you know, there's only so much of the game left, and they've also said they don't want to go, they're not going to go past the story of the game. So where would they find padding? And I think going deeper into the origin of the Seraphites, like maybe even doing some flashbacks as to like the origin of the Prophet and like what her deal was and like where the Seraphites originated and like how this island came to be and how this conflict with the wolves came to be would be kind of interesting, because that is all stuff that is kind of in the background of the game. Like it is fleshed out again in like notes that you find in the games. This is similar to that Isaac scene that we got earlier in the season, where it's like you know, in the game you as Ellie find a Fedra truck with a bunch of bodies in it that have been blown up, but you don't really know what happened. But here in the show, it turns into this scene where Isaac defects and blows up a bunch of his squad. So I think that we very much could see more of the Scars, and I'm curious to see if we get a little bit more of their ideology and their origin story and how their prophet became their prophet and why there are multiple ones of them. I don't know. My general theory on this is that it's kind of like, you know, any messianic figure sometimes gets, over the years, gets represented differently, right? You know how like Jesus was from the Middle East, but he's often represented as like a white dude. So like, you know, maybe that's what we're working with here, but maybe there's more to the story that the show wants to give us.
I mean, if you're going to reject technology as part of your belief system, I suppose one of the side effects is you can forget what somebody originally looked like within a decade of having formed that belief system.
Yeah, they probably don't have a whole lot of pictures of the prophet laying around.
Doesn't seem like it. But right before we get into actually discussing the episode, talking about the official podcast, which I suggest you listen to, it is very interesting. Very specifically, and like not a lot of showrunners choose this outlet in sort of giving us more of a peek into what the intent was behind the show. Whether or not that intent was executed correctly is definitely going to be something we talk about later on in this podcast episode. But it's always interesting to get a peek. I was a little miffed at the end of this week's podcast episode where everybody was just very excited to get started on season three. And I'm like, I realize for you that's next week, but for me that is several years. And so like we're together on the excitement, but I think the creators are benefiting a little bit from the excitement here in May 2025 because they get to, you know, boot up a writer's room and write their way out of some problems that they've created for themselves. Like, you know, having a gigantic stadium set apparently at the end of this week. So let's talk about convergence and some of those traps they've set, and some of our narrative conclusions here in season two of The Last of Us. This episode, like I said, called Convergence, written by Craig Mazin, Neil Druckmann, and Hallie Gross, co-creator and co-writer of the video game Last of Us Part II. She's back doing her stuff. Directed by Nina Lopez Corrado, it is the end of season two of The Last of Us. And I think, for the most part, lives up a little bit to the HBO, I don't know, stereotypical thing. It definitely started after season one of Game of Thrones, but has also gone over to other shows where the penultimate episode is the climax and the sort of final episode is a type of complicating setting up where we're going to go the next season. This one, apparently, and again, I've only sort of watched the game and Neil's played the game, but ending very similar to a pivot point in the middle of the game that we've saved to talking about in the storm. But Neil, I want you to be able to take a victory lap here. You for a while have been like, this is where it's going to end. You didn't have the little bit of Abby bit at the end of it.
Sure.
But in terms of the cut to black, you were very much like, they're going to do it just like the game.
Yeah, I was, you know, I like being right. And this is another one where, and I think I went back and forth on this, whether they were going to go this far, because this does feel a little fast, right? We talked about this as we went through the season, especially when they got to the Nora scene so early, right? In like episode five, I was like, this feels like they're kind of rushing it. And it still does feel a little fast to me that they've gotten to this part of the game so quickly. And I think that there are a number of reasons why. I think only having seven episodes in this season is potentially a problem. You know, and I think that works against the show in a number of ways. But I also, you know, we've been saying in the storm, for those who have been staying in the calm, that this would be a very risky place to end, and a genuinely sort of insane place to end your season of television, especially knowing that we're going to have multiple years until the next season comes out, because it's not weird for an HBO show to end on a cliffhanger, right? Season one of Game of Thrones ends with Daenerys walking out of the fire with three baby dragons on her. And you're like, oh shit, what the hell? What's going to happen with this lady, right? Is she fireproof? We'll never know. And
well, we will on the show.
We will on the show, but we don't on the books. But the difference with Thrones, right, with these big cliffhangers that they would end with, that or the Jon Snow one that came in later seasons, is that we knew that we were getting another season, like a year or maybe 18 months at the most from now. And there was that sort of comfort blanket of knowing that you're going to get those answers fairly soon. So the hope is, I guess, that The Last of Us doesn't take its time getting to another season, because I think that will be a very frustrating thing for folks who haven't played the game and are just watching the television show and who aren't aren't spoiler obsessed people, who aren't going to actually just Google it, right? I'm sure plenty of people have Googled it to figure out what the hell just happened. Like, did Ellie just get shot and die at the end of this episode? Is probably a very highly searched Google term. And I'm sure the AI is doing a great job of answering it for people. But I think it does present kind of a risk for that portion of the audience. For me, as a person who's played the video game, I'm like, oh, this is all right. They went there, and I have the full knowledge of, like, having played the full video game and knowing what comes next, and knowing that my favorite part of the game is what happens right after this. So I'm okay with it, but I'm also fully aware that if I were just watching this as a TV show and had no knowledge of what was going on, from a criticism lens, I was reading Alan Sepinwall's review, for example, who clearly does not seem to have played the game, or is not applying that knowledge in his review, expressed a lot of frustration in what he called, I think, a cheap cliffhanger, a hollow cliffhanger. And I think that's a pretty fair criticism of where this sort of leaves the season. It works for me, but I don't think it's going to work for everybody. And I think it's one of those things that it's possible that once season 3 is done and out and everybody sees this Abby arc that we're about to go on, right? Now that we know that the next portion of the story is, we start with Abby's day one in Seattle and we see what happened to her and loop all the way back around to the theater. Once you see that story, it makes a whole lot of sense as to why you needed to see that story. But you're not going to get that for a while. So in between now and then, it's okay, I think, to be pretty frustrated with the show. And I guess the bet that they're making is that people aren't going to abandon the show in between now and then, which is, that's the risk.
I mean, I agree it's a risk. I also wonder how much of that you could write off, because with such a distance, really, you're going to get that off time is a long time to stay mad.
Sure.
But it's also,
and a lot of other things are going to happen. Other HBO shows are going to come along and make you feel all kinds of other emotions on a Sunday night in between now and then. So
yeah, and then Last of Us will come back around, you might be like, oh, finally, or you might be like, oh, I remember The Last of Us, and then have to binge the whole thing again on whatever streaming service is called, whatever HBO Max is called at that point. And you know, that is also like a sum total gain. So I agree it's a big risk. I'm just wondering, like, was it, I think the question is more, did they piss off people who didn't play the video game enough that they're going to not even give it a chance
Sure.
the next time?
Yeah.
And that, I think, depends a lot on what the narrative conclusions were this season. I mean, I think moving the flashback of Joel on the porch from what would have been the ending of the game to the end of last week, you know, sort of gave us some sort of narrative conclusion. What did this week's episode bring to you in terms of, like, a clarity of what this show's about, if anything? I guess my question would be, I think this episode and this season overall, we are dealing with a different adaptation of Ellie than what the game even portrays, I think, at this point. She's, like, much more conflicted. She has moments that allow her to not necessarily be, the way they talked about it on the official podcast is, it's like her revenge is more like an addiction. If it's not immediately in front of her, she's a slightly more willing to abandon it. But like the second it's dangled in front of her, she sort of goes directly at it, which we see her, you know, leave Jesse to go to the aquarium in this episode. Do you think that is a consistent Ellie with A, what you played, or B, is that sort of addiction parallel enough to carry you into thinking she would abandon Jesse to go to the aquarium?
This is where it's a little tough, because I think that this is maybe one of the problems I have with how quickly they've gotten here, because I think it shorts Ellie's character quite a bit. Because as you're playing the game, you go through significantly more violent scenarios with Ellie, right? Especially in part two, there is far fewer interactions with the infected, but there's a lot more of Ellie having to deal with other humans and having to have extremely violent encounters with the wolves and the Seraphites, and to kind of go further down this rabbit hole. So it's like, I feel like the show's version of Ellie does have that addiction, but it feels a little bit less purposeful than it does in the game. And it feels like you're a little bit like you're not as far down the rabbit hole. Like I'll give you an example. The scene where Ellie gets back to the theater and she goes into the dressing room with Dina and she like takes off her shirt and shows Dina her back and it's all like messed up, right? Was interesting to me because I'm like, in the game, it's a very similar scene, but the difference is you've just gone through this harrowing sequence where Ellie is like gone through a bunch of violent stuff. She's been attacked. She's been beaten. In the sequence with Nora, she actually falls through the floor in the hospital with Nora instead of being chased down the elevator shaft. Like she grabs, like they're being chased by soldiers and she grabs Nora and like they jump and like fall and land on the floor. So it's like there's a more fulsome explanation for why Ellie is so beat up. And I think the show kind of yada yada yadas it. And we just kind of get to the point where Ellie is in sort of this rough shape. And I feel like to the audience that has not experienced the game, it might feel like the show is just sort of skipping some beats. And that combined with, you know, Ellie being a little bit less, it makes Ellie seem a little bit less like capable or a little bit less, less of a force than she is in the game. And I think that that sort of does a disservice to her character to a certain extent. And that's from a like a conceptualization. And I don't think that's a performance thing. I think Bella Ramsey's performance is still very excellent. And I don't even necessarily think that that is a problem in the way that they're writing the show. It feels like a function of not having enough time, right? It feels like a function of not only having 7 episodes and having to get from Joel's death to this theater scene in such a short time and work in all the flashbacks and set up, you know, the stuff with Isaac and the wolves. And, you know, it feels like, again, it feels like they kind of rush it. And we get this portrait of Ellie who is, yes, very addicted to the revenge, but I don't know if it's as solidified and as clear just how unable she is to shake this idea of revenge as it is in the game, right? Like, you know, the show, it just feels like sort of a spur of the moment thing sometimes where it's like she sees the whale and the Ferris wheel and she remembers, oh right, I gotta go get Abby, you know, I gotta ditch my friends and continue this. Whereas in the game, by the time you get to that point, you're just like, there's no way she's going to give up this quest to find Abby after all she's gone through. There's just like no way she's going to turn and leave Seattle, no matter what. And I don't know if the show had enough time to get Ellie to that place. And I don't think that's necessarily, you know, anyone's specific fault, except for maybe HBO's fault for not giving them like 10 episodes to get there. But you know, ultimately they get to the place where it's like, and I think where they seem to compensate, where the show does a pretty decent job of compensating, is by doing stuff like making the scene with Owen and Mel more fucked up than it is in the game, right? Like Mel's death is significantly more harrowing here than it is in the video game. For Ellie, it's significantly more traumatizing because I think it's like it's an efficiency thing. We have to more efficiently traumatize Ellie in the show than you do in the game because you just don't have enough time to put her through more drawn out trauma. So
well, it's also, if that makes sense.
It's a different violence as a mechanic in a video game is different than violence as used in a story. So like in season two, you know, for the most part, with the, I think the exception of this episode, we have to check in with the infected, you know, like once it's an HBO show. They have a whole bunch of infected. They have a budget to create them.
Sure.
Why not have like, you know, these little infected things and you have them in the game because those are your adversaries. Or as you mentioned, eventually they become human adversaries. But it, you know, every once in a while, there has to be a time that you're thrown into conflict and you either have to hide or confront these people. When the game makes you confront it, again, violence becomes a mechanic of the game. Every once in a while, if you aren't exercising the mechanic of violence, you're making a person watch a whole bunch of cutscenes doing, you know, quick time events. And so that's a little bit different. Trying to adapt that to the show, I can see why they maybe thought that adding in the violence to the cordyceps would have been enough to sort of like speed run it like you're talking about. But also I think they didn't have to, or they weren't as concerned with using the violence as showing Ellie's mindset as they were allowing Bella Ramsey to act it.
Mm-hmm.
So like the biggest problem I have with Ellie in season two is, again, probably because of abbreviation of time, it's just she goes back and forth convincingly, so convincingly that in the moment I don't see it. But when I'm writing and when I'm thinking back and I'm connecting all the dots from Ellie's perspective, which I do think is important, especially since we're going to switch perspectives, so many of these things happen where she has to turn on a dime. And I think the show's really good at pivoting and being like, okay, we're going to focus on this now. But I don't think the character through line really works until after you've seen the Joel flashback. So really, in a way, this sort of like addiction thing they were talking about on the official podcast for the Convergence episode, I like this was the first time it worked for me because I had seen the full, I was finally emotionally up to date with where Ellie was because I had seen where she left it with Joel.
Mm-hmm.
So the structure of the storytelling, I think they knew that was a really strong moment, but I think you're right that we had to rush getting there. And maybe it's like Craig Mazin says in the official podcast that part of the reason this season was so short and part of the reason they sped run it is like the death of Joel takes so much gravity out that essentially what they've done is they've made season two about the death of Joel and given themselves the narrative freedom to make season three about something else, which is going to be interesting, yeah. But is depending on your audience coming back for season three.
Sure. And listen, as a Caitlin Dever believer I've been a fan for many years. It's ever since Justified, as I've said many times, I have no doubt that Caitlin Dever can carry however much of the season is going to be about Abby's perspective. And like I've said, the Abby portion of the video game is my favorite part of the video game. It's excellent. So I think it's entirely possible that season three is going to go off and be great. But I do think that they are going to, in the interim, pay a bit of a price for having rushed to get there. I also think that one thing that is interesting and a change that they made consciously, an adaptation change that they consciously made here that I think cuts a little bit against Ellie as a character that we're rooting for, I guess, because, you know, from my perspective, as I was playing the game, you're mostly rooting for Ellie kind of all the way up to the aquarium, right? Like you're still rooting for her to find Abby, get revenge, especially because when you're playing the game, you don't know about Abby's dad until after this whole sequence, right? We in the TV show know more about Abby than the game players knew at this point. But this idea that Ellie has been, that we now know that Ellie has been withholding this information from Dina about what she knew about Joel. And then the fact that she tells Dina this information, which is a new thing. This does not happen in the game, where she admits to Dina that she knew about Joel and what Joel did. And then has in turn kept them in Seattle, I think is part of this like back and forth swaying with Ellie's character that might be jarring people a little bit in the TV only audience, right? Where it's like, why, especially after Ellie finds out that Dina's pregnant and they have their, you know, nice, sweet, romantic moment. Why wouldn't she tell her then? Why wouldn't she be more amenable to just leaving? Why is she going to continue this? I don't know if the show does as good of a job of explaining why Ellie can't give up the fight, why Ellie can't give up the quest for revenge. You know, we'll see. We'll see how that works out for him, I guess.
Yeah.
We'll see if the audience sticks with it. My only thing is, you know, for folks listening to this who are thinking about giving up on the show, again, the stuff that comes after is really good, so I wouldn't give up on it just yet. But I completely understand your frustration, and I think most of it is just because they've gone too quickly. You know, efficiency came for The Last of Us a little early.
Way too fast.
Yeah.
Well, and that's sort of what the galling thing is about maybe a season four now, is I'm like, oh, okay. And it is probably ultimately down to like HBO, because I don't want any of these episodes to look worse. And what HBO is spending the money on in 7 episodes a season is they're probably spending as much money as they would spend on a 10 episode season. It just needs to be distributed over fewer episodes. We get things like season 2, which has, you know, the assault on Jackson sort of thrown in there.
Mm-hmm.
And we get those sort of, you know, fun, more cinematic adaptation points, which ultimately is what we want. We want them to save some budget for some encounters in season 3, but also what more can we get out of it, knowing that HBO thinks this is popular. And then, like, the galling thing is they're like, all like, well, time to work on season 3. Like, if they knew it was going to exist, if HBO got here and realized it was going to exist, why aren't they working on it already, is sort of the general feeling.
Sure.
But we'll see how it goes. Before we move on to the other parts of the episode, like, I do want to talk about the changes to the Mel scene, obviously, and a little bit more about the Dina scene if we want to. But I do want to talk, just break out Young Mazzino's portrayal of Jesse. This is the Jesse episode in the classic TV sense, where really like Jesse right up until he dies. Like, sure. Finally, some peeks into this guy, what makes him tick. It all makes sense. He's got the mantle of leadership of Jackson on his shoulders. He now realizes his ex-girlfriend is pregnant, and then boom, right in the face.
Sure. He does the classic Chekhov's line of dialogue, "I can't die." Yeah. Like, oh no, Jesse
can't die now because I'm gonna be a father. what'd you think about, you know, it is tropey, sure, but sort of condensing everything into making us feel good about Jesse only to yank that right out from under us?
I mean, I think this is some of the stuff that I like, because this is stuff you don't get in the game. You don't get a lot of time with Jesse, and I think Jesse as a character is a little bit, he's less Captain Wyoming in the game and a little bit more reckless because of the order at which people are going to Seattle. Mm-hmm. Right. Tommy goes first, and then Ellie and Dina go after him, and then Jesse goes. So it's a little bit more, I think it's a little bit more in line with the TV show version of Jesse that they're building. And I think it works pretty well. I'm not as sold on him letting Ellie kind of off the hook at the end. I mean, I do think that it shows, you know, when he's like, "I know that you would burn the world down," or whatever, to help me. I think it shows that he has a pretty good understanding of Ellie, maybe a better understanding than the show itself does of Ellie. But it does kind of let her off the hook right there at the end. And that's kind of a weird, interesting addition, I guess, to the story. Whether or not that was necessary, especially knowing that he's about to run through a door and get shot in the face, is, you know, it is what it is. But I don't fault the show for wanting to spend a little bit more time fleshing out Jesse's character. And again, it's them sort of trying to, in the time that they have, do this work to position someone opposite of Ellie, trying to make mm-hmm. the argument that you've got to give up this revenge. You know, you've got to give up your addiction to revenge. You've got to take care of the community that you have now and let go of this desire to avenge Joel, and something that we kind of know that Ellie can't do, right? And that she gives her an opportunity to express that in the scene where they're you know, arguing about it and looking out at the city. So I think it works, and I you know, young Mazzino's given a good performance, so I don't fault them for wanting to give him more to do, especially knowing that Jesse's done here. And I love the little anecdotes that he's talked about in interviews where he like did all of his own stunts in that last scene. So like he came and did like 20 takes of just falling face first. That's rough, man. But
yeah,
you know, good on him for you know, sticking to the bit and being very committed to making that scene very authentic. And it's rough, but you know, you walk through that door, you don't expect Rambo Abby to be on the other side of it, but there she is.
I mean, I like the juice they gave it. I do like that she sort of lets Ellie off the hook. I do. I mean, I think I agree that it's a little iffy in the story sense, but in the sense that like we want the maximum mourning for Jesse as a character, because by the time we return to this, it could be 2 years and 8 hours from when we last spent time with this character. Mm-hmm. So I'm very happy that they did manage to sort of like cut out a chunk of this episode to like get to know him, get to know his perspective, sort of have the showdown I was expecting between like who's going to be the father and who's going to be the daddy sort of conversation. But then also just making it about who defines themselves as a good person. I was missing this perspective. Mm-hmm. I thought it was going to maybe come from Tommy because he's tried to warn Ellie and Dina with this perspective, this better for the community perspective, before she gave the speech. But have it sort of reiterated here at the end, because I do think even though this is a story that's tragically about how you can't, you know, just keep feeding into this cycle of violent revenge, it is ultimately about pondering tribalism. And just because Jackson is the good example we've seen from that, doesn't mean that it's any less, which is, I think, why they throw in that scene where Ellie wants to go help the Seraphite man that's been captured. And Jess has to pull it back and being like, I'm not dying for this. If I'm going to die, I'm going to die for our people.
Yeah.
So
interestingly enough, Tommy kind of ends up on the other, on Ellie's side of it. I mean, not fully, but like, he's like, you know, when they're talking about Owen and Mel, he's like, they got what they deserved, basically.
Yeah. I think a lot of people are telling Ellie right now what she needs to hear, but also sort of like maybe hiding some complexity. Hopefully we get more with Tommy, though. But definitely if we're going to not see Jesse alive moving forward in our plot in this series, it was nice to spend some of the episode with him. Let's pair the two Scar scenes together since I started talking about it. We have one run-in where the wolves capture this person and Ellie wants to sort of save him, just react impulsively. She wants to do some violence. And then we have a additional scene that is, from my understanding, not from the game, even though mm-hmm. they kind of wanted it to be from the game, where she is washes up from a stormy ocean on the Seraphite Island and is almost disemboweled based on the orders of a very wee child. Exactly. This and the scene with Isaac sort of saying that Abby is the future, I imagine, are like bits of setup. Why do you think we needed them here in this episode?
Well, the Isaac scene, I think I understand pretty well, right? It's there to establish, I think, an importance for Abby as far as like how important she is to the wolves, and establish that they don't know where she is. Which is an interesting question going into season three. Like, mm-hmm. how do they not know where she is? You know, to be determined answer on that one. This Ellie scene is what's curious about it for me is that they were talking about how they wanted to put it in the game. And I was trying to reason out, like, why wouldn't they put it in the game? And I feel like, doesn't it feel kind of redundant? Right. Especially given the fact that we've already seen the Seraphites do this in the park. Mm-hmm. Right. So we've established that this is sort of their ritual and that they hang people and slice them open.
So I think it has to be even the kids, because she keeps calling the guy that gets captured the first time.
Okay.
Like, he's just a kid. And then it's like a kid is like, you are going to be disemboweled. And that's the only reason I could come up for it, for why these two things have to be said now. I don't think she needs to be on the island.
That's true.
I understand why they took it out of the game.
Well, and I understand why it didn't end up in the game, because there's not really any Seraphite kids in the game, because most of your interaction with the Seraphite is that you're killing them with Ellie. And even this game doesn't have you kill children. Right. Like, that's not a thing that happens in video games. But it is interesting to me that they stuck this in here, because, you know, they could have had Ellie just fall into the ocean and then end up at the aquarium like it happens in the game. But, you know, I guess it's one more thing there. Yes. To mirror the scene with the kid where it's like she wanted to save the kid, which again, that's another funny one for the show. It's like she wanted to go and take on, like, I think Jesse says, like, there's two of us and there's six of them. And I'm just thinking, like, I don't know, man, if this is the game, those are pretty good odds. that's actually
seen worse.
There are sequences in the game where it's like 1 on 20. And you have to figure out a way to win as Ellie. And so, like, 2 on 6 is nothing. But yeah, so I guess those scenes sort of pair together well. And again, it's there to further establish that there are two sides to this conflict, the wolves and the Seraphites, that neither of which has clean hands, right? Both of which are doing extremely brutal things, and both of which are doing extremely brutal things and potentially, at least in the case of Seraphites, indoctrinating that into their society, their community, at a very young age. So this idea mm-hmm. that Ellie and Jesse are arguing with about, like, our community, what would you do for our community, is sort of flipped in the other direction, where it's like, this is what the Seraphites are willing to do for their community. Right. This is what their children are raised to believe, that we protect our community at all costs. And even though, you know, we don't know what this kid understands about Ellie or whether he believes that she's not a wolf, but he doesn't seem to care. Right. He's given her the signal either way. Right. Wolf or no wolf, she's got to go. She's not part of our group. And I think that sort of goes with the rest of the theme, where it's like, this kid, you know, he wouldn't have saved her either way, you know, and the only thing that ultimately yeah. saves her is a random horn blowing off in the distance. And who knows what that was? I'm sure we'll find out at some point.
Neil, I have the unfortunate, reality of having to live in a daylight savings time zone. Mm-hmm. So when Ellie alights onto the water, it was still sunsetting, like, right through my windows. Love my view. Horrible TV setup. Explain to me what your takeaways were from what I understand now to be probably, like, a very technically complex sequence that I basically have forgotten about because I couldn't really see it,
which rough. Is
Ellie getting to the aquarium.
I was going to ask you about this because this is, you know, we have long talked about the HBO shows specifically and the way they put the settings of our televisions to the test. I was house sitting this past weekend, so I was not with my home setup, but I was watching it on a slightly lower resolution television. And I noticed that it was a little muddied, that some of the dark sequences in this. And it wasn't until I watched it again at home on my 4K setup that's, you know, fully properly calibrated, and I watched it in the dark, that I noticed like how detailed it is. And it actually looks really good, especially for being a night sequence with very low light, extremely low light, that is set like on the water where there's just not a lot of detail to the landscape. And, you know, I think the choice of having a fair amount of lightning is pretty good. And I also think that they operate it similar to like what a lot of horror movies do, where it's like they use the darkness to affect, where it's like you just, the darkness is darkness. The scary stuff is in the darkness. We know that she's on the water. The waves are out there. That's where the bad stuff is. When there's something we need our eyes to be drawn to, we get light. You know, we get lightning that lights up Ellie's face. We get an explosion in the background that shows us how far away she is from the island. We get lightning that shows us where the
Ferris wheel
is, stuff like that. So I think it's still a pretty effective sequence. But yeah, this is the first time that all season, I guess, that they've really tested the TV settings. So hopefully everybody had their Neil approved television settings. And again, the number one thing you can do other than having your brightness not cranked all the way up and your contrast turned down a little bit and having your backlight, your automatic backlight setting turned off on your television is to not have ambient light in your room, right? So close your curtains in that situation so that you're not getting a lot of additional light going across your television. But I ultimately thought it was a pretty cool sequence, especially because of the way that they work together numerous different types of stunts, right? Like there was some location stuff with Ellie on the docks. There was they use a dry gimbal I saw in the behind the scenes where it's just like her or like Bella Ramsey. They're on this boat with no water. And then they used a tank, a very large tank. And like, that's not easy stuff to work with, right? Especially with extremely high tech, very expensive camera equipment that you cannot get wet. It comes together pretty seamlessly when you can see it, but I feel like, you know, it's sort of dangerous, but faithfully adapted from the game. Cause the game, that sequence in the game is that dark, you know, true to the apocalypse. Nice. The city of Seattle is not lit up at night, in the post-apocalyptic scenario.
I got the message, which was like, girl, give up. Like, you don't need to keep doing this. So it dramatically worked for me.
Yeah. And I really like the shot where like, she's in the boat and she's cutting across. It's like this wide shot where she's cutting across the water. I think it's after the Seraphite Island, and there's like these lightning bursts and you can just like see the busted up city behind her. It's pretty cool.
Well, I mean, it's good. I just need to watch it at night. And, yeah. You know, there's only been so many nights to watch it. All right, we're finally here. We're at the aquarium. I am very happy to spoil a little bit of the game for our commies by asking you, why am I so happy that Alice the dog is not in this series?
Yeah, this is, well, and this goes with something else that we find out in this episode, which is that Shimmer is still doing pretty well.
Shimmer is alive right where they left him.
The first thing we talked about in the first storm segment of this season was that Shimmer was not going to have a good time, because in the game, Shimmer does not make it through like the first hour of Seattle. And Shimmer has made it all the way to the end of this season, still hanging out in the music store, I assume, listening to some garage rock and just waiting for everybody to travel back to Jackson. And yes, Alice the dog is a dog that is with Owen and Mel at the aquarium, that when you are playing as Ellie and you're infiltrating the aquarium, the first thing you encounter is Alice, and she attacks you, not knowing who you are and not knowing that, you know, when I'm playing Ellie, at least, that you are friendly and that you are a pro dog person, and you have to stab Alice with your switchblade knife is one of the more traumatic things that happens in the game. And goes with, and I think, you know, this seems like a conscious choice that the show has made to spare the animals for the most part. their terrible fates, because especially in the second game, there is a lot of, the wolves have a lot of dogs that Ellie encounters. So there are a lot of dogs that you have to deal with, and you are not able to do so in a pacifist manner. Mm-hmm. You have to do it violently. And the game, for some reason, for some sick reason, people at Naughty Dog, the game has all kinds of really intense animations for how you can murder dogs. And it's really, really, I hate it. I hate it. Hate it. It's my least favorite thing about the game.
That was like the Telltale Walking Dead games where it's like, welcome to episode one, saw off your own arm. You gotta press the screen. You gotta do it. We're not gonna do it for you. Saw off your own arm. Do yep. it.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, video games.
So, you know, when Ellie makes it to the aquarium, that was the most tense I think I've been watching this entire show, was like as she's dropping into, she gets down, she sees like all the bunks, and she's like going through. As she like gets into that hallway, I'm like, this is where it happens. This is where Alice shows up. And when Alice didn't show up, I was like, oh, all right, well. No way the rest of this is going to be at all traumatic, because Alice isn't even here as far as we can tell. So, but
well,
you know.
Unfortunately, they made it worse. Exactly. They made it worse. This is where Neil and I's both of our best line delivery awards, the Swear to Me Best Line Delivery Award, this sequence or this week comes from the sequence for both of us. So, Neil, why don't you start with yours and get us into the what happens with Mel and Owen?
Yep. Well, mine is. Ellie's response after Owen tells Mel she's definitely going to kill us no matter what we do. And Ellie says, no, I won't, because I'm not like you. And I think it's Bella Ramsey. They do a fantastic delivery on this. It's sort of you can feel sort of the air just escaping Ellie's lungs as she's saying this at the end. And I think it's a very important line from a characterization standpoint, in the sense that this is probably the last time in this story that Ellie gets to believe this, you know, because she does believe that she's not like these people, that she's not a cold-blooded revenge monster, and that she wouldn't go... that she wouldn't do something like what Abby did to Joel, something so horrible. And then, you know, whether you consider it to be an accident or not, she immediately does something that is probably just as horrible as what Abby does to Joel, right? It's not as purposeful. She doesn't do it with a golf club, but she definitely, it'd be one thing if she, you know, beat the crap out of Owen, right? Just like she beat up Nora after Nora was kind of terrible about the Joel thing, right? But, you know, the killing of Mel, which takes place similarly in the game up to the point where Mel, in the game, there's more of a physical fight, right? She fights with Owen physically and kills him, and then Mel kind of attacks her and she stabs Mel in the neck with her knife, and then as Owen is dying, he's like, she's pregnant, and that's when Ellie like takes off Mel's jacket and sees that she's pregnant. The show has made a decision here that I think makes it so much worse, which leads us to your best line delivery award.
Yeah, so Ellie shoots Owen through the neck, which also grazes Mel on her neck. Sure. So instead of a stab wound, she gets a...
catches whatever that artery is right there on the side of the neck. I forget which one.
Yeah, the most very bad place to be shot. And rather than be like super mad about it or yell about it, she unzips her jacket to reveal that she's pregnant and asks Ellie to cut the baby out of her since she's going to die and maybe the baby can... survive. So mine is just Is It Out, where Ariella Bearer leaves this season of the show sort of pleading with Ellie to cut her baby out, which is again so much worse, and it's so much worse for a lot of reasons. One, the idea that like she has enough time to be like, okay, but cut it out of me. And to the point where I'm like, as a viewer, I'm like, do I want Ellie to try?
Right.
Like, at this point, like, I know that's probably not going to work out good for anybody, but like, do I want her to try?
Right. Do I want to watch this traumatized 19-year-old try to perform an emergency C-section on a dying woman?
Yep.
I don't think I would want that. Not that I don't think HBO would air that, because I've seen House of the Dragon. It's just like, yikes, man. That is so much worse. And I do think we were talking earlier about the show having to, because they don't have as much time, having to find efficient ways to traumatize Ellie. Having to find efficient ways to get Ellie to the place where she is just completely fucked up by everything that has happened in Seattle. And this is kind of the stuff you have to do to get there. Which is like, you know, they set up obviously the stuff with Dina, and they put Dina in peril, which is not, is very different from what happens in the game, right? In the park. I think it's Jesse actually is the one that gets injured in the park. In the game, and then so we put Dina in peril. Now Ellie's got that on her mind, and then this happens to Mel, and it's not just that she killed a pregnant woman, it's that she killed a pregnant woman, and the pregnant woman wanted her to cut the baby out right at the end in a horrific manner. And you know, I think it's, again, really great performance from Bella Ramsey, just absolutely turns into a horrified child after this, you know. And I kind of like that we get we also get the part of the scene where Tommy and Jesse show up as well, because it's like, you know,
it is nice, and it's nice that Tommy tries to, you know, comfort her, even though I'm not sure he believes what he says, but he says the right thing to get her out of there, which I think is ultimately important. And then the episode, you know, as we said, get rid of Jesse. Then we open up again in Seattle day one with our final Game of Thrones Easter egg for the week, Neil. tell me about this book.
Well, it's funny because I'm curious as to why they had to change this, given that in the game, when Abby wakes up, which is interesting because in the game there, this is not the first thing you see after that scene. There's like a whole, there's a different flashback it cuts to, which we don't have to talk about because it's a little bit of a spoiler. But eventually you do get to the scene with Abby at the stadium where she wakes up in her, I guess, apartment at the stadium. And she's reading City of Thieves, which is a 2008 historical fiction novel by someone named David Benioff, who is one of the co-creators of Game of Thrones, you know, of Weiss and Benioff fame. But in the show, they've changed it to Thieves of the City by Ben Davidoff, which is, I guess, it's one of those things where, like, they changed it, I suppose, so that they don't get sued. But also, it's an HBO show, and he's an HBO guy. But then again, he's a Netflix guy now, so maybe
it's not worth it.
Maybe the relationship between David Benioff and HBO is so not copacetic at this point that they didn't even want to try it. So I thought that was kind of funny that they made the change, because I've always kind of liked that connection. Now, I will say, Dave, that there's a lot that I enjoy about them sort of ending here with this loop back
day
to
one Abby. Title.
Yeah. I mean, it's cool that it sets up a lot about not only projecting that season three is going to start with looping back to Abby's story, but it gives us a better sense of the scale of the WLF's operations. The you know, the stadium sequence in the game is super impressive, right? I think it's a very cool sequence to sort of show that this is not kind of like you know, earlier in the season when they first get to Seattle and Ellie and Dina are having that conversation where it's like, oh, it doesn't sound, nobody's heard of them in a while. It doesn't sound like there's a whole lot of them. And then we see the shot of like an army marching down the street with tanks. Mm-hmm. And it's like at every turn, the Wolves are far more capable and well-armed and outfitted than anyone would expect. And this really does a good job of showing that off. So I think that's cool. And it does a really good job of setting us up. Now, again, whether that is going to continue, that whether that's going to be effective for the audience that has not played the game is a whole nother question entirely, and a question that won't be answered for a long time. But like for me, I got kind of hyped. I was like, oh, all right, we're now, like, as much as I would criticize the show for rushing to get here, I'm glad that we're here. Because yeah, this is where stuff really jumps off, in my opinion. But you know, I don't blame folks for being a little frustrated with it.
I just think ultimately we're going to find out that HBO would have saved a lot of money if it was one 15 episode season.
Sure. Yeah, and even if it was like a 15 episode season that took like a couple of month break and ended and took like a mid-season break at this cliffhanger.
Like you're the Bears.
Yeah. You know, or like a Squid Game, like what Squid Game has done. Mm-hmm. And still plenty of people have had pretty major criticisms of Squid Game, the most recent season of Squid Game sort of doing a similar thing where it was like, just as the action was ramping up, the season's over. But that show is coming back in like a couple of weeks, and that season ended in December. So it's only been like 6 months, you know, and that's not going to feel so bad once we get the conclusion of that story. This is a different animal because it could be 2 years, you know, or more mm-hmm. by the time we get the answers. And, you know, I have plenty of time on my hands these days, but I cannot sit on the street corner and shout my Caitlin Dever believership from now until like 2028. I have other shit to do. So HBO, you know, unless HBO is going to send me money for that, I cannot sit here and advocate for people to be patient. They're going to have to do quite a lot of work, you know, in between now and then, or, you know, it's just going to come down to delivering a banger season 3 that makes everybody forget how mad they were about this cliffhanger, if they were mad.
Well, Neil, you're going to make me feel better about this cliffhanger, because after we pause for a brief moment, we're going to enter the storm, which is where Neil's going to tell me about how stuff I saw this episode is going to pop up in season 3. And we're going to talk about things that we're going to do in season 3, maybe, if we had to guess. But we don't have any spoilers from the production of HBO The Last of Us. We only have those from the game. So if you want to stick around, that's fine. If not, see you in 3 years. No, see you next week to talk about a season retrospective. And until then, be excellent. But until now, let's go to the storm.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQ Bar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.
First storm and the last.
Neil, So many things during this episode where I'm like, this is a potential crossover point, depending on how much they want to reshoot this.
Sure.
So what do you think of what we saw in this episode that is actually going to play directly into what we see in season 3?
Oh, tons of stuff. I mean, it's a veritable Easter egg hunt, or I guess you could call it they've seeded a lot of stuff for Abby's story. And there's some very overt things. I guess we could kind of work our way back, right? Like, specifically in the scene where Abby shows up, you'll notice that she's got a very significant bruise around her neck.
Mm-hmm.
Because she also goes through a very similar situation that Ellie goes through, where she gets strung up by the Seraphites, which is why I sort of mentioned that it feels kind of redundant that Ellie goes through it in this episode. Right. I didn't go as far as to say that we're also going to see Abby, because the Abby scene is far worse. Like, she's up there far longer and she comes much closer to not surviving the situation. Mm-hmm. And I really did feel when they showed it earlier in the season that that's what they were setting up, right? Like, that's kind of what the whole park thing teases in the game, which is like, you see it as Ellie and you witness them doing it to like a random dude. And then later when you see the Seraphites grab Abby, you're like, oh shit, here it comes. You know, we don't necessarily need to see it happen to Ellie, but okay. But that's there. And that's very important. I did think it was interesting that they added in the scene with Isaac talking about how Abby was like,
Abby's the leader,
number one lieutenant, because in the game she is referenced as somebody, I forget which character it is. It might be Mel talks about, how she's Isaac's top scar killer. Right. Like she's basically the number one soldier of the wolves. And this is one of the things that is used to sort of explain why Isaac let them go to Jackson in the first place. Right. Because that's one of the big questions,
right,
which is like, why would you let Abby take five or six of the other soldiers, essentially, and go off on this crazy goose chase to find this random dude to get revenge for this thing that happened in Salt Lake City. So, you know, it turns out Abby's very important in the wolves hierarchy. She's a very good tier one operator, as I believe they're called. She's the John Wick of the wolves. and that is something that comes through. I don't think that's something that comes through in what we've seen of Abby so far, right? Like in the scene where she's in the like early season two stuff, but it's definitely something that we will start to see in her stuff in season three, where she's far more capable and she's a total badass. And I think that's all very important. And you kind of see it in this final scene in the theater, where she's like very much in command of the situation, right? She doesn't hesitate to shoot Jesse. She's clearly gotten the best of Tommy very quickly. She's not fucking around, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, she's obviously not going to kill Ellie. There's a lot more story to come. She's pretty hardcore. So I like that they kind of seeded that in there, and that they've teased that she's missing, which is very important, right? Because her not being with the wolves and her basically starting out, on patrol as a wolf on day one and ending up completely on the run from the wolves by day three is part of her arc that I think is really cool. So that's there. The other one that I think not a lot of people have been pointing out, in fact, I was watching your friend of mine, Ryan Airy, his Screen Crush Easter egg video, and he didn't even point mm-hmm. this out. I was like, oh, I got one that Ryan Airy didn't even get in his like 90 Easter eggs about this episode video. When they are walking down the street in Seattle, Jesse and Ellie, and you can sort of see the storm rolling in. It's actually the sequence where they see the prophet's picture or the prophet mural. And she's like, oh, there's multiple of them.
There's more of them
up in the buildings. You can see this scaffolding, this red scaffolding that is connecting multiple buildings together that looks like it's like fallen on the buildings, but it's actually a bridge that the Seraphites have built that connects the skyscrapers at the top. And what we learn in the second game is that one of the ways that the Seraphites are able to move around the city without being caught by the wolves is that they move very high. they move on these like bridges that they have built in between the skyscrapers, and they use these elevators that they've basically built out of like the you know how like window cleaners on skyscrapers have those like things mm-hmm. that go up and down? They basically made
the
elevators,
propelling carts.
Yeah, those like carts. So they made elevators out of those, and it's one of the more I contend, having played both games multiple times now, that it is the most tense sequence in either game, where you playing as Abby are with Lev, and Lev is like, we'll go up to the roofs and we'll take, because Abby is a badass, but she's notoriously has a fear of heights, which comes into play here. And they go up and you have to cross these scaffolding, and you're with Lev, this little seraphite teenager who is like climbing around like a little monkey and like has no fear, and is just like zipping around on these bridges. And Abby is like, and you have to like use your left stick on your controller to like balance. And the amount of times I have taken Abby and fallen off of a skyscraper to her death is very high, probably more than I have died to the Rat King. And the Rat King is not an easy boss fight. So it's this, and what I assume is going to be a very cool sequence in season 3, which is a very nervous Abby who we've already seen be extremely capable and badass. This is where she and Lev are going to the hospital to try and get some medical supplies, because they need they're going to perform they need medical supplies so that Mel can perform surgery on Lev's sister Yara, which is also going to come back here in a second.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to cross these towers. So it was very cool seeing that little detail in there. If you look up on the skyscraper, you can see the scaffolding that looks like a crane. It looks like a crane that's been laid horizontally across the skyscrapers that eventually Abby is going to have to traverse in an extremely terrifying way. And I kind of can't wait to see them pull that off, because it, you know, the way the game does it is harrowing. Like the wind is whipping around. The sound design of it is very cool. The way you control the character makes it extremely realistic. And, you know, you fall a lot if you're not very good at it, like I am.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was very cool. Very cool little seedling for that, that I think, you know, a lot of folks seem to be missing. And then when we get to the aquarium, we see the results of the surgery.
Yeah.
That Mel performs on Yara. When we first meet Yara and Lev, it's the wolves that smash her. They basically take a hammer to her forearm and smash the bone to bits. And then eventually Mel has to amputate her arm. But they don't have all the medical supplies they need at the aquarium. Abby's got to make a run to the hospital, ends up in the hospital basement looking for supplies, where she meets our big bad villain on level B3, which is another thing that Neil Druckmann teased, specifically called out on the official podcast. You know, they were talking about, oh, what are the questions that are going to get answered in a season 3? And he's like, what's on level B3 at the hospital?
Yep, like, someone's designing that Rat King.
That absolutely is what I want to see. Is the Rat King, and to see, you know, how far they go with that design, which for the uninitiated who have not heard us talk about the Rat King, if you're jumping into the spoiler section, you know, they teased this when they were at the hospital in that scene where they first revealed the spores. They talked about how this hospital in Seattle is where they brought the first infected during the original outbreak. And that mm-hmm. those levels of the hospital is where sort of like the oldest infected are. And that's why they had to seal it off as hard as they could possibly seal it off. And the Rat King is a sort of hybrid infected that is made up of multiple, I think it's like 7 or 8 infected, like fused together. There's like a bloater in there. There's a couple of runners in there. It's like this monstrous thing that is like a bunch of them that have just sort of teamed up and become the nightmarish Siamese. It's not even twin. It's like a Siamese quintuplet.
It is based off a Rat King. This is a real thing where rats spend enough time in a confined environment that their tails will start getting tangled together, and then eventually they'll just start melding into one another.
Yeah.
It is gross. Rat kings are gross.
Very gross.
And this one's going to be even grosser because it'll be a Cordyceps rat king.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you fight it, you have to, it comes in state. It's a great boss fight because it's got multiple stages. Like you have to shoot it. Basically you hit it with fire. You hit it with bombs and stuff first, and it breaks apart into two different pieces, and you got to kill the big piece first, and then you got to chase down the little piece and kill it. It's a pretty great sequence and is genuinely terrifying, and something where you have to do a lot of running away from it. So it's a lot of like running and hiding. So I'm kind of curious to see how they end up designing that sequence and how it shows off, maybe a little bit of a different choreography than what we've seen so far, you know, because it's not a horde that's going to be chasing after Abby. It's not even necessarily like the clicker sequences that we've seen where it's like a couple of clickers. It's one big ass boss. And he's really nasty and he can like slam through walls and shit. It's very cool. So I'm excited. Very excited.
Yeah. Can't wait.
So they've definitely started to tease that. The other one is the sniper, right? They talk about over the radio. They hear that there's a sniper out by the marina, and Ellie and Jesse are like, oh, that's definitely Tommy. And I think this episode kind of confirms that it is Tommy because Jesse eventually shows up with Tommy. It is Tommy. Mm-hmm. What we don't know yet is that he is shooting at Abby and Manny and Yara on the bridge, the marina. Abby is actually at the marina trying to get a boat to go to the Seraphite Island because she is there when shit goes down. She doesn't go with the wolves. She is going on her own mission with Yara to try and recover Lev, who has returned to the island. And she's trying to save him before the wolves make their big assault. So she's there, and then the assault happens and she has to escape. Another one of the more harrowing sequences in the game where you're playing as Abby and this war breaks out and the island is like getting blown up around you and you just have to get off the island. And another one of the more gnarly like 1v1 fights is like as you're trying to get to a boat to get off the island, this giant Seraphite dude shows up with like a sickle and you have to fight him hand to hand as Abby. So it'll be, I'm one of the things I'm curious about in season 3 is how much of the physicality they translate, because they have changed Abby physicality wise in their casting of Caitlin Dever. She doesn't have the, you know, I forget what they call her, what they say in the game. She's like built like something. But she's got huge arms in the game. She's you know, very, very cut, I guess. She's I'm struggling to find the word, but she's ripped as shit in the game. And that is one of the things that comes into play where it's like, when you're playing as Ellie, you do a lot of like stabbing with your knife to finish off like infected and other human characters, right? Like Ellie will sneak up and stab people in the neck. Abby doesn't have a knife. Abby's got her arms and she will like put people in a headlock and choke them out with her biceps. So I'm curious to see how that changes with the physicality of Caitlin Dever being a little bit different, and see if they make those changes, or I don't know, maybe they still have her do it, you know?
I mean, this did remind me about a slight correction. Somebody emailed back after our first episode when we were talking about how like online people were not very nice to Abby and the people that played Abby. And I brought up that they'd sort of run this one actress, Jocelyn Mettler, offline, and somebody had written in is like, you know, Abby was voiced by Laura Bailey. I don't know why you credited the wrong person. I just want to say Laura Bailey absolutely voiced Abby.
Yeah.
Mettler was her face model. And then, as you were saying, big guns, they had a entirely other model, the athlete Colleen Fauch, provide the scans for the physique. So they're like, we're going to take this one lady's face, and we're going to put it on a female athlete's body, and it's going to be voiced by Laura Bailey, who is much closer to Caitlin Dever in physique than Colleen Fauch. So that's the amalgamation of people that make the video game Abby so intimidating.
Yeah. And you know, she's great. She's one of my favorite video game characters of all time. I know she's ultimately very controversial. Plenty of video game playing weirdos do not like Abby. It was controversial for me the first time I played it, but only because when you get the perspective switch in the game, you're like, wait, what? Like, what are we doing here? Like, no way this game is going to make me like Abby. No way this game is going to flip. Because, again, you have, when you're playing the game, you have even less information than people watching the show have. You don't even know that it was Abby's dad. Abby's just like some woman who showed up and murdered Joel. Right?
Right.
Like, we don't even know why she did it until later. And the journey of discovering that and then going on this journey where she defects from the WLF and empathizes with these Seraphite kids and goes on that journey, which, you know, is ultimately what kind of saves Ellie and Dina from getting murdered by Abby's arms in the theater eventually, is very important. So I'll be curious to see how they handle the physicality element. I'm again, very confident in Caitlin Dever's acting ability, that she can pull off the dramatic elements of Abby's performance, and the rest of it's just choreography and figuring out a way to sort of pull it all off and get Abby to a place where she lives up to the promise of being Isaac's number one soldier. Right. Maybe in the show, it's more that she is, she's a soldier that uses her wit more than her physicality.
Strategic soldier.
Yeah. You know,
we'll see.
She might have to outsmart the Rat King.
Yeah. Dear Storm listener, we are going to try to connect those dots with like some sort of semblance to predict next week what we think a season 3 and maybe season 4 are going to be. We're also going to, you know, do our awards and stuff for the calm section. But before we go out, there is this one Raven that I think is a great question to get us thinking about next week's Storm section. Neil, what does Common Haven have to say for us?
Yes. Excellent, Raven. And again, if you have Storm related questions, feel free to send those over. stormofspoilers@gmail.com. Common Haven sent us a significantly longer one that we're going to dig into next week, because there's some really, really great stuff, potential filling out of the story for a season 3 and 4. But this is a good question for now, which is, what is your preferred ratio of Abby versus Ellie's screen time in season 3? Would you like to see the Abby and Ellie theater showdown return at the midpoint of season 3, 60-40, allowing Bella Ramsey and Isabella Merced to rejoin the cast after 4 or 5 episode absence, or in the penultimate episode, like an 80-20 split or a 90-10 split? This is, I guess, assuming that it's a 10 episode season. If it's the latter, do you think the show could continue to hold your interest or emotional investment in Ellie's journey, with Bella Ramsey being absent for almost the entirety of season 3? Really good question. I don't think they could wait until the end of the season to bring them back. I think that if it's going to follow the structure of the game faithfully, and it's going to completely immerse us in Abby's perspective, it's got to be like 4 episodes max, and then maybe in the 5th episode we return to the theater, and then they have,
so that would be the halfway option, assuming 10 episodes for this season.
So sort of halfway at the most. Then again, there's a lot of stuff you could do in Abby's storyline. And I think that they've already shown the willingness to do this bold thing, which is end on this cliffhanger. the next bold thing is, can you do a huge portion of the next season without the sort of main stars of your show in it? You know, we already know Pedro Pascal is pretty much done, aside from potentially more flashbacks. But can you start the season without Bella Ramsey and Isabella Merced? I don't know. That to me feels like upping the risk pretty significantly. But I do think that there's enough story that they, you know, like, especially if they do dig into the Abby flashbacks, right? There's Abby flashbacks to, like, her with her dad in her youth. There's flashbacks with her and the rest of her crew that I think are really important that they should do. And so it's like, if they fully commit, then yeah, it could be most of the season if they wanted it to be. That would just be like extremely wild decision for an HBO show. You know, that'd be like, yeah, if like Game of Thrones came back for, you know, like season two and didn't have any of the Lannisters in it until like the last two episodes. And then all of a sudden we're back at King's Landing.
I mean, I'm for it only because what are you going to do to be like a groundbreaking TV show? And I think being close to an anthology, but being not an anthology, is how much can you hold back on bringing back Bella and Isabella? I think they're very compelling characters here in season two.
And this is, I do think, what made the game groundbreaking. I think,
yes,
I think this is one of the things that definitely made this, especially the second game, what it is, right? The first game is a far more straightforward narrative structure, beginning, middle, and end, and sort of doesn't have much of a cliffhanger at the end. The second game is just wild as hell, man. Like, it's a wild experience.
Well, but if they're talking about a season four, then at the end of the actual conclusion of the theater scene would be where I would cut it off to go to season four. So
like season three ends like at the farmhouse.
So yeah, at the beginning of the farmhouse.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just like, it's pretty tough. It's pretty tough because then you're asking people to accept the basically exact same sort of cliffhanger as here at the end of season two, at the end of season three, where you're like, all right, we did the theater. Here's 2 seconds of the farmhouse. See you in 2 years, you know? Sure. So,
well, and then, and then it's a huge mystery as to what season four is, because then you really have to pad out a lot of story after that. But it gives you an opportunity to at least maybe bounce between two storylines, between Ellie and Abby, that eventually brings them together.
You could bring in some flashbacks of those things, or you could bring in more Jackson on the side of those things, because they're all eventually going to maybe come back together. It'll be interesting to see what they think their story is, but can't wait to talk to you more about it next week, and I'll maybe have more specific breakdown points if I assume that it's not the end of the theater. Where else could I cut it off? Because the problem is, my understanding is, like, once you save Lev from the island, it's pretty clear where, you know, Abby's morals stand. So once she's done with the theater, she kind of arcs out, and then we're back to Bella being the motivating force from the Ellie side. So that, can you do that switch in one season? Maybe, because that allows the entire character arc season for Abby to be like a thing. But then I guess you got to make up another arc for Abby if they're going to share time in season four.
Yep. Just means the Rat King's got to be the star, man.
Rat King star.
Got to be the showstopper that is promised for season three.
I'm into it. I mean, and the island sequence, the Seraphine Island sequence, has to be pretty big.
That sequence has got to really go off.
All right, so we'll be back next week to wrap up this season of The Last of Us and peer forward into what we think might happen. And also, you know, give some superlatives. We want to glaze this season of The Last of Us appropriately. So until then, stay safe out there. Be excellent to each other.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.